Hello, I'm Andrea Tabchar, a college public relations professor based in Toronto. My goal for my podcast is to interview PR practitioners with interesting stories to tell, and I wanted to share those with my students. I've decided to call it PR Delivered.
But I do feel pretty confident the don't be a robot rule will always be a good one. So if you can be adaptable and think about, you know, the new platforms and which ones people are using and migrating to and getting in front of those people, that's great. But I think the core of it, where it's like you want to have a brand that is authentic and credible, and that you protect that brand from people who might try to get you to do things you don't feel comfortable with, then you have the core of something you can build on and make a career out of.
Teaching social media to students across three programs, public relations, digital communications, and journalism, means that I have to consider the role social media will play in their future careers. While PR and Digicom students may become social media content creators working for agencies and organizations, journalism students will create content for a different purpose. Their content will be more personal. After all, it will be their own reputations at stake. In this podcast, we explore the role of social media in the work of a journalist. As both a Humber prof and a reporter, Matt Elliott is uniquely positioned to share the inside scoop on how budding journalists should leverage social media, how to create content, navigate the challenges, and ensure that what is posted is trustworthy. Matt is a freelance city columnist for the Toronto Star, writes for CBC Toronto, and launched an independent City Hall newsletter called City Hall Watcher. Matt also teaches journalism at Humber College. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Andrea. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
That's great. I'm so happy to have this opportunity. I'll be teaching social media again at Humber College, and I always feel that my journalism students are getting a very PR-focused look at social media because that's my perspective. So I'm really looking forward to having our conversation so that they get that journalism perspective as well. So thank you. Let's start. If you could tell us a bit about yourself, how did you get into journalism?
I sort of have a unique pathway into this industry in that it wasn't entirely intentional. I went to school for journalism in Halifax, university there. I did that, but didn't really click with me at the time. And after I graduated, I got away from journalism altogether and was working in IT, doing some stuff for not-for-profits, and it was pretty good. But started to feel the pull of journalism again when Rob Ford became the mayor of Toronto. And you might remember, Andrea, Rob Ford was a character, I guess. We'll just leave it at that. It was a very interesting time municipally, that level. I had moved to Toronto a couple of years before and was really getting into like the, you know, what makes a great city and how does that happen politically, and what are the stories that are there? And when the Ford election happened, I got really into reading a lot about what was happening. And I'm a big fan of like, okay, if you have this hobby or this interest, you know, is there a way that you don't necessarily make money from it, but is there a way you can turn it into something tangible? You know, so you can look back on this time in your life when you were obsessed with this one thing and say, oh, I actually have something to sort of read or look back on from that time. So this was 2011, and blogs were kind of the thing still then. I mean, social was starting, Twitter had been around for a few years then, but people were still blogging. So I started a blog with the idea this would be a place where I would basically just like link to the articles I read about, you know, what Rob Ford was doing that interested me. And that way, you know, instead of just spending all my time reading these articles, I'd have like a bit of a record of this time. And quickly it sort of snowballed from there. I was not just linking to other people. I was doing my own little bits of writing, cracking jokes, and joining Twitter and getting a bit involved in that community. And after doing the blog about, you know, Rob Ford City Hall for about a year, I got an offer from the Metro newspaper here. And that was sort of my foot in the door. I moved my blog over to their website, started doing stuff for the newspaper. And, before I knew it, I was leaving my full-time job to jump full-time into the world of freelance journalism, which I did not expect to be doing. But I was, in my mid-20s, there was an opportunity to take that chance. And, I'd always loved writing. I just wasn't sure about journalism. So it just all sort of came together, and they've been doing it now for about a decade, and so far so good.
Thank you for that. What I love about your story is the advice that it's ringing in my head is that writers write, and mm-hmm. I love that nothing stopped you from writing, and eventually your writing got recognized and you became the journalist you had one day hoped to be. And great advice to anybody who is an aspiring author, journalist, any kind of profession, really, just do it. And eventually yeah. It could work out. So that's brilliant. So thank you. Inspiring words for the classes. Let's dive into social media specifically. What role, and you addressed some of it already in your introduction, but what role do you see social media playing in your job as a journalist?
It's huge. I can't overstate how important Twitter specifically was for me, as far as getting my name out there, getting people to know what I was doing, connecting with other people, building a bit of a community around my work and other people's work. I don't think it would have worked like it did if I didn't have that specific platform. And I mean, we could talk a bit more about the various platforms and what they're useful for these days. But, at the time, Twitter was the right one for what I was doing. I don't know necessarily it would be the exact same if I was doing it today. But that was the platform that everybody was gravitating towards for the kind of stuff I was doing. So it worked quite well for me. And it's really, you can put your stuff out there, but then you have this question of like, okay, how do I make sure somebody reads this? And that to me is the role social media plays. So I've always, approached Twitter specifically as sort of my professional place, my place where it's mostly work stuff related to City Hall, with the idea that if somebody wants to know what's happening locally, they can follow me on Twitter and get that information. And it's not, a little bit about City Hall here and then like 30 tweets about video games and then, some stuff about the Blue Jays or whatever. Like, I'm very interested in these things as well, but I try to keep my social media work on Twitter accessible in a way where it's like, okay, if you follow me here, you know generally what you're gonna get. You might get the occasional sports tweet or whatever, but it's gonna be very skewed towards the City Hall stuff. Another thing that I do, and this is a bit unique, lots of journalists don't do this, but I've always used Twitter as sort of my public reporter's notebook. So if I'm at a City Hall meeting, I am not, jotting down my thoughts in a pad or whatever with a pen. My handwriting is terrible, so it probably wouldn't be very useful for me to do that, because I'd go back to it later and I would have no idea what I had written. So I use Twitter for that reason. I do a lot of live tweeting of events, and I find it's very helpful for me, because when I want to look back on, a council meeting from 4 years ago or whatever, or a press conference, I can use the search tool on Twitter and just, limit my search to my own tweets and find it there. So I've built myself this like record now going back 10 years that I often find myself going back to. So I didn't expect that to happen, but it's been, useful, not just for the, connections to other people part, which, social media is often thought of being useful for that, but also useful for me as an archive of information from, a decade of doing this.
You raised the point that you've been using Twitter for 10 years now, and mm-hmm. that you are part of the community that you've built and mm-hmm. you've contributed to a specific Twitter community. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I mean, early on, this was huge, and I mean, it actually ended up with a bit. A Globe and Mail did a feature story about, you know, five or six of us who were known as the sort of young 20-somethings who were, you know, always in the gallery at City Hall during council meetings, and were always tweeting, and, you know, had a style where it was, you know, we want to let people know what's happening, but we also mix in some analysis, some opinion, and some jokes. You know, kept it fun, which I think was needed during the Rob Ford years because it was very tumultuous. So, you know, people chronicling it was important, but also, you know, finding some levity in some of these moments as well, and just sort of trying to define what it meant for Toronto, I think. So yeah, there's a community, and it was sort of formed around the TO Poly hashtag, and there were a few of us that I think got pretty well known for contributing to that and being people that people looked to see what was going on. And that was enormous. You know, we'd get together and we'd have drinks after council meetings and stuff like that, and help each other out. And, you know, it was cool to see how, you know, some of these people went on to, you know, careers in journalism. Others, you know, it was more of a hobby type of thing, but that community connection was really important. And if, you know, for me as a freelancer, like, I don't have a newsroom to go to, so, you know, you think there's value in having that sort of coworker thing that doesn't happen in an office, but can happen over a social media platform and give you some perspective and just, you know, some feeling like you're not just out there alone screaming into a void. There are other people doing the exact same thing that you are, and there's value in that.
Would you say that if a student, a journalism student, or a new grad is interested in Toronto politics, is there value to them obviously following that hashtag, but then jumping in and sharing? You know, I know a lot of times students say, but I have nothing to say. What is your take on that?
Everybody has something to say. So this idea that you have nothing to say, I think, is sort of cheating yourself out of, you know, you are a person. You have accumulated these years of experiences and perspectives. And, you know, the great thing about local politics is that it is all very accessible, right? So, you know, I tell students, like, because I often get the whole, like, oh, I don't care about politics. And I said, well, I mean, how did you get to the campus today, back when going to campus was a thing? And they'll say, well, you know, I took the bus. And I was like, well, how was that? And they'll say, oh, it was terrible. It was late and it was crowded. And I was like, okay, that's politics. You know, or they say, I drove. And I was like, well, how was that? And they say, well, gas is too expensive, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's politics too. Like, you have all these experiences. And again, like, municipal politics is great because there's like a direct connection between your experience as a person on the street and political decisions being made, you know, about, you know, sidewalks being installed and maintained, and the city of the parks in your community, and all this stuff. So I think getting past that sort of initial wave of defeatism that young people tend to have, and I totally had it too, you know, there's this sort of moment where you almost feel like you're, you know, looking over a cliff, and you're thinking, okay, like, I know I'm interested in this stuff. I feel like I have something to say. I don't know that anybody's going to care about what I'm going to say, but my choices are to, you know, step off the cliff, give it a shot, see what happens, or just sort of stay up here exactly where I am right now and not move at all. And I think, you know, there's always value in moving. Like, you don't. Like, one of the great things about, especially, you know, being a student and being young and being in your 20s, is that, you know, this is the time in your life where you can make some mistakes and you can try stuff out. And if it doesn't go the way you wanted, then you're not too worse for wear. You know, like, when I left journalism and worked in IT for a while, that was a fine job. I could have done that for my entire career, but I also felt, you know, like, I want to create something. And it just happened to be that this was the opportunity to do that. So yeah, I encourage students, and I do this every year, like, you know, don't sell yourself short. You have something to say. You may not know what it is yet, but it's there inside you somewhere.
Great. And there's a tip on a community to join, you know, hashtag TO Poly, which,
That's
you know,
right.
I see come up all the time. Again, another, just one more question before we carry on, related to your individual Twitter use. Do you follow the metrics on Twitter? Do you follow what is working? Do you does that impact how you use the space?
It does. I try not to get too overly focused on metrics, just because there, you know, have been times in my career where I've had like a story that really landed with people and went, you know, viral, so to speak, you know, and lots of people were reading it and it was great. And it was getting all kinds of attention and, you know, all retweets were blowing up and I was, you know, having a really good day. And that is a good day, but there's a hangover effect that happens after something like that, where, you know, instead of just continuing to do the work, you suddenly, you know, next thing you publish, it doesn't go viral and you think, oh no, I must have screwed that up somehow. Like that's, I must have missed what worked the first time. Why isn't everything I do going viral now? You know, you have some stories where you feel like, you know, this is really going to be huge on social media, and then you publish it and it's not, and you get like, you know, a handful of retweets or whatever and some likes, and that's the end of it. Sometimes you write something and you think, yeah, this is too esoteric or weird, and it's no way it's going to land with people, and it goes out there in the world and it does good numbers on Twitter. So, you know, I try not to think about it too much just from the perspective of, you know, for me, it's sort of, you know, you can't predict it too much, but I am aware of, you know, when I have something that's resonating with people. And the way I do that is, you know, like I have notifications on my phone still for like retweets and likes and stuff like that. And, you know, I could turn that off, and I know some people do, but I like it. That's really the extent of how I track the metrics. I don't spend a lot of time like going to like the Twitter analytics tools or stuff that tells you like engagement numbers or whatever, just because I find it's easier for me to just sort of stay at the higher level and say, okay, if this thing that I posted got like, you know, a few hundred likes and I see that coming in, then that is, you know, a story that's landed with people, which is good to know. And if it's not a link to a story or whatever, often what I will use Twitter for is almost like focus grouping in a weird way, where it's like, okay, I have this thought on this issue. All I have right now, I don't have a column or a story on it yet, but I have a thought, and I'll put that out there. And if I see that it is resonating with people and, you know, getting, you know, a few retweets and likes here or there, it's like, okay, this is something that I might want to build into something that gets published somewhere. So, you know, it's not the most formal process in the world. I don't let it like control me entirely. And I think there's a danger in, you know, if you find yourself like with the analytics page always up and you're looking at the numbers as they change second to second, I think there's a good argument you need to just stop doing that and focus on writing and the work and getting stuff out there. But at the same time, like the great thing about social is you do get some real-time indication of what's landing with people, and that is super valuable.
That's a great point about using it as a focus group and sort of a finger on the pulse. When I go back to my student group, you know, in the class, we've got PR students, we've got Digicom students, digital communications, and journalism. The use of the tool is different. And, you know, often the PR students and the Digicom students are going to be using this tool on behalf of, you know, an organization, an agency, and they are going to be looking at those metrics very differently. And that will be guiding a lot of, you know, the evaluations on success. What are some of the challenges that you face as an individual who is using this tool for your work? Mm-hmm. But it's really, as I said in my opening, it really is your reputation on the line when you're using this tool. Can you just talk a little bit about those challenges?
Yeah, no, I mean, I had an example early on in my career where I had just started contributing articles to a publication, and they reached out and wanted to know if I would consider changing my Twitter handle so it would actually have the name of the media organization in the Twitter handle. And, you know, there was a part of me that was like, well, what's the big deal? And but there's another part of me that's like, well, I mean, the enduring thing for me in the journalism industry is me, right? Like I am the constant. Gigs I have, jobs I have, those are likely going to come and go. I mean, it is a reality of journalism today that you're probably not going to land a job in a newsroom and have that job for 40 years and then retire. Like, that is not the way things are going right now, and it's not really the way I want things to go. Like, one of the things I like about journalism is that I have the opportunity to sort of jump around. If I get bored with something, or have a relationship with an editor that isn't really quite clicking, I can make that leap and do something else. So I, had this moment early in my career where they said, can you sort of think about, rebranding your social to match our media brand? And, but I'm sure the next request would have been like, and, can you tweet about these stories for us every day and all this stuff? And I turned them down, and I probably was a not necessarily great for my relationship with that media company in the immediate term. But I'm very glad I did it, because, people know me as, my Twitter handle is Graphic Matt. People know me as that. And if I was changing it, I would lose some of that recognition, and that's bad for me. And I also have a reputation that I've built as, like, you follow me and you are going to, get my thoughts. It's not going to be me conveying the thoughts of somebody else. It's not going to be me linking to stories that I don't, agree with, or whatever. Like, there's a reason why I post stuff I do, and all of it comes back to, this is stuff that I want to put out in the world. I'm not doing it on behalf of anybody else. So yeah, I would say, like, it's, with young journalists especially, there's going to be people who are going to try to get you to use your social platform for their ends, and that's fine if, what the place you're working for, if they share your values and you feel comfortable doing that, then, go to it. But if you have that moment where you're thinking, okay, now I'm putting stuff out there under my name and I don't really believe it, that's when you really have to think long and hard about, okay, it's not easy to sort of push back against this stuff, especially when you're new and you're just feeling lucky to have the opportunity. But You got to realize that, this is your brand, and brand matters a lot. And, I think, especially with journalism, credibility is so important. So if people know you as somebody who speaks the truth and does good work and has integrity, that will go a long way. If you get known as somebody who just sort of, is a extension of some company, then that, I think, over the long term, your career will be a net negative. So stand up, defend it, is the best advice I can give.
Now, I wanted to push a little bit more on the whole reliable and trustworthy side, because we talk a lot about that in public relations, the importance of trust, the challenges that organizations, journalists, politicians, even influencers are facing. They're being scrutinized. Are they being authentic? So you've pointed out how important it is to be yourself. What are some ways that you ensure that your content, given that some of your content is opinion-based, how do you guarantee that you are providing that most reliable, trustworthy information to your readers?
There's so many things that I do. I try to always ground my journalism in numbers. That's sort of what I have built my reputation around. So a lot of my columns will include a number as sort of the thing that I'm basing it all on, which is helpful, because that I'm making sure that there's like a kernel of factual truth to it. But the other thing is, you have to be incredibly careful. And with Twitter especially, there's this pressure to be the first to get stuff out there before somebody else. And that is dangerous, because that is where mistakes are made. If you're thinking, oh, if I can just, get this tweet out there about this breaking news event before everybody else, then everybody will be, looking at my tweet and retweeting my tweet, and it's going to be a great day for me, which might be true, but there are huge amounts of peril in that. And it's much better to be right than to be first. So I often tell the students, to take a breath. Like, when you're dealing with a breaking news event, it can feel overwhelming and it can feel scary. And that's where mistakes are made. And, what people are going to remember after this is the actual factual information. They're not going to remember which person was the first one to get it out there on Twitter. The other thing is that you have to own your mistakes. Nobody has a flawless record. I don't have a flawless record. And one of the really negative things about Twitter and other platforms is, you know, people will put something out there and then they will, it'll start going viral and they'll realize there's a mistake in it. And instead of deleting it, they will just, you know, let it continue to propagate out there because there's this idea, well, you know, it's a minor, you might tell yourself, oh, it's just a minor factual thing or whatever. And people are, you know, the general idea of what I put out there is right. And it's like, no, you've got to be willing to hit that delete button and issue a correction. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, every time I have to do it, I feel this sense of mortification. Like, I have screwed up today. I've made a mistake. But I got to tell you, like, over time, when people see you as the person who is willing to own up to, oops, I got this number a little bit wrong, or I got this quote wrong, and I've deleted the original and I've issued a correction, that builds credibility too, right? Because people understand that not everybody is perfect. And somebody who did sort of claim to have a flawless record of never getting anything wrong, you'd sort of look at them and say, really? Like, are you even sure about that? Because I mean, human nature is that, you know, mistakes are made here and there, even if it's just like little typos and things like that. And I mean, there's, you know, you have to sort of set your own policies. I will not, you know, delete a tweet with a minor typo in a quote or whatever if I feel like the meaning is accurate. I might just reply to that tweet in a thread and say, hey, sorry, got this, spelled this word wrong or whatever in the heat of the moment. People get that too. But you just sort of got to be open and honest and transparent about, you know, the work that you're doing and the fact that you're a human being and you're not going to nail everything all the time. But if you can make sure that you are not contributing to the amount of misinformation in the world, but actually, you know, working against misinformation, then I think you're on the side of angels.
That's it's great that you raised the issue of sort of fake news and disinformation. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, you've talked about how you make sure that you're staying accurate, but in terms of the challenges you're facing today with the disinformation that's circulating around, can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is. It's hard, and it's one of the big negatives of, you know, doing this job and having, sort of doing, being so public on Twitter as well. Like, I have, you know, a window on Tuesdays now, which is generally when my Toronto Star column gets published and it gets out there in the world. And the Toronto Star's main Twitter account will tweet it and include my handle in it, which is great. I mean, it leads to more people seeing my work, which is amazing. But I also know it means that I am going to get like a flood of replies from people who are peddling misinformation and are often being very negative, and, you know, in ways that are, that can be personal as well. And it is, you know, what I experience is nowhere near what some of my female colleagues experience on this, which is way worse. And it's just a sort of toxic mix of some people who, you know, have very, very strong beliefs that are not rooted in fact and are willing to personally attack journalists who are putting, you know, factual information or out into the world. And so it is very hard. You know, I've written about vaccines a few times over the last few months, and the amount of disinformation I get is in my inbox afterwards, pushing back against it is unbelievable. But at the same time, you know, if you let that deter you, let that stop you, then who's ultimately winning, right? Like, I think it's the only way that we are going to push back against this is to push back with factual information and to do the work of journalism and to tell the stories that are real. And it can be very challenging, and I think it's getting more challenging. I don't think the trend is necessarily a good trend right now, but at the same time, yeah, no, I feel a little bit like this is a fight, and we got to be on the right side of it.
Thank you for that. One way that I see you sort of contributing to the accurate information is this newsletter that you have. It's an independent online newsletter called City Hall Watcher. Tell us a little bit about that and what role that plays.
Oh, yeah, that's been my most rewarding job I've ever had as a journalist. You know, I've had great jobs. Toronto Star, CBC have been very good to me. Then lots of cool stuff. But the City Hall Watcher newsletter, which I started in January of 2019, has been just unbelievably rewarding. And the reason for that is because it's mine, you know, I control it. It's something I started. And the reason I started it was mostly because, you know, after having a very good relationship with Metro News for a number of years, they changed their format and then ultimately stopped publishing, which happens in this industry. And I found myself, you know, without like a steady gig, and had one of those sort of, okay, now what am I going to do moments. And, you know, people were very gracious and there were opportunities for me, but I had this feeling like, okay, I want to have something that is me, that I can control. It goes back to that soul idea of like protecting your brand, right? Like I don't want to just work for other people. I want to have something to see if there's a way that I can be generating some income and informing people all through a medium that I control. And it was lucky because newsletters, email newsletters were becoming more prominent in the industry. Substack was becoming a platform. I was very early with them. So I put City Hall Watcher out there as a weekly newsletter, sort of summarizing what's going on at City Hall. I charge people $5 a month or $50 a year to subscribe. And it's been, you know, when I had started it, I thought, okay, if I get, say, 200 subscribers, that is, you know, $10,000-ish by year, which is not a full-time job, not even really a part-time job, but it's, you know, the amount of freelance gigs I would have to do to make $10,000 a year is not insignificant. So if I can do that on my own, why not do it? So, you know, I said, okay, I wanted to hit 200, and then I wanted to hit 500, and then I wanted to hit about 1,000, and about 1,000 subscribers is where I'm at today. It's not, you know, my full-time job, but when I mix it in with the other things I'm doing, the columns for the Toronto Star and the teaching at Humber and some other odd gigs here and there, it has built myself a really stable career, because, you know, other gigs can come and go, but this newsletter, it's all on me, right? As long as I'm doing it and people are subscribing, doing the work, then it's going to be around. And that's an enormously freeing feeling. So I really would encourage, you know, young people especially to think about, you know, newsletters, because even if, you know, you want to start with something free, like building up an email list of people that are into your work, even if it starts with, you know, 10 or 20 or whatever, and it's mostly your family, like you can build that and you can take that with you. And that is enormous, because it can turn into something, and it's an opportunity to identify who are the people that really care about the stuff you're doing. And, you know, I wish I had started this way sooner than I did. So yeah, I'd really recommend people look very strongly at the newsletter world right now, because it's a very cool time to get into it.
What's interesting is if we actually go back, you know, to the just after the printing press times, what emerged after the printing press but newsletters, and then that emerged into, you know, full form newspapers and everything. You know, it's almost like we're cycling back, because I think that, you know, if I'm gonna just throw my two cents in, I think we're realizing that we need to pay for good content. And I've been saying that for a long time. Like, what you get for free is that's the quality you get, you know, nothing really good comes for free. I appreciate that, that direction you're sort of going in and sharing with the students and the listeners on that. And you're really reiterating what we talk about in social media class all the time, is that everyone is now a producer and a consumer of content. And so we have, you know, social media are the platforms that allow us to do this, which is amazing. Like, you've created this whole side gig for yourself on your own initiative. And I think that's super inspiring. Now all my PR people are going to become journalists. Like, oh, wow, no, stop. We need some PR people too. This is awesome. What advice would you give to the students? And I'm not going to limit it to the journalism students, because I think your advice is great for all of them. What advice would you give to the students in terms of their relationship with social media?
I always start with the number one rule for me is don't be a robot. And that sounds weird, maybe, but one of the things I've noticed is, you know, I'll come into a classroom of young students and they're all, you know, fun, hilarious, interesting people with lots to say. And then I'll say, okay, now use social media for something related to the class. And a lot of that personality just drops away and it becomes just, you know, they do like, I'll say, okay, here's an article you've written, write a tweet about it. And the tweet will just be, here's my latest article on this topic and a link to that article and like 9 hashtags. And it's like, you know, what happened to the fun and interesting person that put that together? And I do think, like, I mean, to give the young people some credit, like, I think a lot of it is what you mentioned earlier, the sort of feeling like they have nothing to put out there into the world and the trepidation about sort of stepping off that cliff and becoming a more public persona or person. There's also some concern that, you know, there's various standards about, you know, is what's professional on social media. And I think some people think you just, you know, you're avatar needs to be a photo of you in a suit and tie, and you should, you know, only be doing things this way. And I push back against that because maybe it's because of the industry I'm in. And if you were doing, you know, journalism about corporate finance, it would be different than journalism about City Hall for sure. But I have always found that there is a huge opportunity for humor and levity and, you know, being the person that you are and composing your social media like you would have a conversation with a friend and less like you would write an academic essay. And so this is something that I've been working on and trying to figure out the best way to teach it and to, you know, translate that into action, because I do find that it is one of the biggest challenge with social media and using it for journalism in my experience. I'd be curious to know if it's similar for PR and digital communications as well. But like I think so much of what worked for me is that, you know, I have a style where I'm trying always to make my stuff accessible and fun when fun is appropriate. It's not always appropriate. And funny when there's a joke to be made, and just, you know, this is easy to read and relate to. And relate to is a key part of it too, right? Like you want people to feel like there's a human being here, because when you have that human connection, that's where people will, you know, be more likely to click on your links and check your stuff out. And even if you want to go that way, give you money to read more of what you're writing. So I think if I was just somebody who all of my social posts were, you know, here's a headline and a link and a hashtag, I would not, you know, be where I am. I felt like I provided a persona on social media that let people sort of get a sense of who I am and what I care about. And that has been valuable for me.
Thank you for sharing that. That's great insight. And I have some assignments for the students related to tweeting, and you've just inspired me that I might give them, you know, an article that maybe you've written or somebody's written and say, okay, tweet about this. I think I'm noodling around this assignment already. That's been very, very insightful for me, and I'm sure for the listeners. One last question before we get to your final thoughts is, is there anyone in addition to you and your community on TO Poly that you would recommend students follow? People who are sort of demonstrating what you're talking about. Is there anyone you would sort of give a shout out to that is worth taking a look at to inspire?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people. I'm very locked into the world of politics at the provincial and municipal level these days, but I also spent a lot of time over the last 4 years with like a side obsession with US politics, because that was an interesting time as well, with a lot of parallels to what I experienced with Rob Ford, the Trump stuff. So, you know, I look to a lot of, you know, the people I've discovered who were covering the Trump world that were doing some really interesting stuff. And Ariel Edwards-Levy, who is somebody who tweets about polling, I found fascinating. Sopan Deb, New York Times journalist, He started in politics, and now he's covering basketball. And he's been fascinating because he really got good at providing like instant transcripts of stuff that was happening at the Trump events early on. And I found that enormously useful. And then he would provide context on it and all that kind of stuff. So he was great. He wrote a great book as well about reconnecting with his father, which is a side note, but I really enjoyed it. So that's Sopan Deb. And then, you know, some, I had another one that I was going to say, but I've forgotten what it was. But yeah, I just, for me, I'm always fascinated by like the little communities that spring up over, you know, political events that maybe not everybody was expecting, and people who are helpful in providing context for that. You know, the big example locally would be Daniel Dale, who I worked with, you know, as somebody who was covering City Hall at the same time he was. And then he's gone on to take what he was doing so good during the Rob Ford era and, you know, doing a very similar thing for the Trump era. And that is incredibly inspiring. And I just think there's so much value in, you know, it's kind of similar to the stuff I do where you find a niche and you just sort of work it. And his niche was, you know, counting the lies that Donald Trump told, and that ended up being, I think, very, very valuable for getting through that era. So if you can find like a little space for yourself in an area where nobody's really doing this and there's some value there and you can do it over social, then that is a good place to be.
Great. Thank you. I knew Daniel Dale's name would pop up in our interview. I was debating sort of starting with him and his fact-checking work. And I see a parallel with what you do. And that's great. So what I'd like to do is invite you, if you have any final thoughts, our audience, are your students, my students, new grads, any practitioners that are interested in the various story angles here on PR Delivered. So any final thoughts?
Yeah, the one thing I would say is that the hard thing about teaching social media is that, you know, just when you think you've figured it out and set some rules around it, everything has changed. So, you know, like I mentioned this earlier, like I came in at a time when Twitter was the place to be and everything was working for me on that platform. If I was to start today, it might be something entirely different. So one of the things I'm very conscious of is the idea that, okay, I've sort of figured out what worked for me and set some parameters and some rules around the way that I did it. But, you know, it might not entirely apply today or at all apply today. So I really think it's important that we keep leaving room for innovation, for throwing out, you know, some of the rules of the past and, you know, defining something new with the way that people use social media. So I don't think you can get boxed in, but I do feel pretty confident the don't be a robot rule will always be a good one. So if you can be adaptable and think about, you know, the new platforms and which ones people are using and migrating to and getting in front of those people, that's great. But I think the core of it, where it's like you want to have a brand that is authentic and credible, and that you protect that brand from people who might try to get you to do things you don't feel comfortable with, then you have the core of something you can build on and make a career out of. And it's just, after that, it's just getting the stuff out there. You know, there's always a moment before I hit that tweet button or that post button or that send email button on my newsletter where I have an abject moment of terror because I am putting something out there into the world. I have checked it. I'm pretty sure it is as right as it's going to be. Isn't always. But, you know, when it does get out there and you start getting some feedback on it and people are telling you they like your stuff, that is an enormously great feeling and makes it all worth it. So there's this cycle of terror and gratitude and then terror again, and you just sort of keep at it. And if, you know, you're the kind of person that finds creativity appealing, then I think, you know, you're going to create. And it's a really good time to do that. There's downsides, but just get out there, push through the terror, hit that button, get it out there in the world.
Awesome. Thank you for those inspiring words, inspiring our students to get out there, don't be robots, and see how social media is evolving and be part of that evolution and take some ownership. So very inspiring. I thank you so much, Matt Elliott, for joining me on PR Delivered today.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Andrea.
PR Delivered is available on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts. You can reach me, Andrea Tavchar, on Twitter or LinkedIn. Thank you to Ryan Garbett for music and production.